Hello, IndyCar fans. Hey, hey, thanks for joining us again. By the way, that song was Something in the Air, Thunderclap Newman, One Hit Wonder. Awesome song, but ridiculous piano solo in the middle of that, if you ever check that one out. But it's kind of appropriate. Something in the Air, and then We've Got to Get It Together. And so, I don't know, I just thought it was a good fit for the whole IndyCar thing right now, especially with the thermal being somewhat controversial. I mean,
I think this will be an interesting discussion. The thermal, officially called like the Thermal Club $1 million challenge or something. You know, I watched it live, obviously. And when I was doing my prep for this episode, you know, I was watching some of the YouTube videos that IndyCar had posted and stuff to get my notes together. And I saw a lot of negativity from fans commenting on that online. So I think that's probably something we should address directly. Before we do that, though, I do want to say from our prior episode, our review of St. Pete, first of all, thanks to all of our listeners for that, for joining us again in the 2024 season. We got a note from one of our listeners named Bob, who told us about Santino Frucci's race. You should have made the connection that Frucci's successful race may have had to do with the new technical alliance that Foyt has with Penske. This is something that needs to be monitored for the rest of the season. Don't forget that Frucci has already been on Penske's radar as a substitute driver. I think that's a great point. Like we talked about in that episode, Frucci obviously had a great outing with Foyt, and it's sort of yet to be seen how much the Penske alliance is really going to change or improve the performance of that team, but definitely worth monitoring. So thanks for sharing that with us, Bob. And I just want to remind everyone that you too can share your thoughts with us. Just go to IndyCarFanPodcast.com and click, I forget exactly what the link is, but it's like contact us or something, and you can share your thoughts with us directly.
Yeah, and in regards to that comment, I said something about this on our preseason podcast that actually it's kind of a two-way street. I think with the Foyt team doing so well at Indianapolis last year and Ferrucci practically winning the thing, I think that the alliance is not just one way. You know, it's going to, I think, Penske probably wouldn't get into it if he didn't think there was some benefit to them. So Bob's right. I mean, Penske's keeping an eye on Ferrucci this way, and I think they got a lot. You know, there's definitely something to be learned from the Foyt team at Indianapolis, which is always priority number one for Penske. Let's get to thermal, though. I mean, pretty unique place. It's an awesome layout. I mean, what a great test track. All kinds of different corners, huge sweepers, double apexes, like all kinds of really cool stuff as far as the layout goes. And I think the drivers enjoyed, you know, the challenge of that track. There's nothing straightforward about it. I think there's a few different lines you can take, and I guess the tire deck's really good. I mean, it would be a great facility. At least the layout would be great for an official IndyCar race. But since they were there anyway to do this two-day test, I think it's, you know, not a bad idea to go ahead and tack on an event and draw fans in and, you know, experiment a little bit. So
I mean, I think that's exactly it. I think part of the reason I see a lot of negativity online, which to me is fans expressing that they were disappointed, and you know, they tuned in to watch it on TV and they just didn't really get what they were hoping for, I guess, or didn't find it particularly entertaining. But it really was just a test weekend. I mean, we had what, like 5 hours of testing on Friday, another five or six even on Saturday, or sorry, four on Saturday. And then the competition itself was almost an afterthought. It was just like two group qualifying Saturday night. And then the race was probably at like 9 a.m. local time or something. And so I think that was just to throw a little, you know, to showcase IndyCar racing a little bit on top of what was otherwise just a test weekend at Thermal. But the thing is, it was billed as the $1 million Thermal Club Challenge or whatever, which sounds like some big event. You know, I mean, it was short heat races. There was action in them. It's not like nothing happened at all, but it wasn't like this big, crazy, you know, shootout for $1 million. I mean, it didn't even pay the winner a full million. It was like over a $1 million purse, but they billed it as the $1 million challenge, which sort of implies that the winner's going to get $1 million, and that wasn't the case either. So I think I see where the negativity is coming from. I don't think it was billed very well, but you and I both watched it on TV. I mean, I'm sure the vast majority of IndyCar fans watched it on TV because it was basically a members only event unless you could pay out of pocket for whatever the absurdly high GA prices were. I think they did come down quite a bit before the event, so you could get in anyways. But we have somebody who was there actually who can speak about the experience, you know, actually being there in person, what it was like.
Yeah. So my brother-in-law, Jeff, is going to join us here, and he was just there, and we'll let him talk about it, but let's cue him up right now. All right, so we got our guest on, Jeff Hannon. Thanks for joining us, and good to see you again, man.
Good to see you guys, too.
So we understand you were front and center at Thermal.
Yeah, I got a pretty unique opportunity. Well, hey, first of all, you know, just being a family member of yours and a relation, I really couldn't have married into a better family who loves racing and hockey, so... the racing thing, I guess, is the focus here. But my background, you know, my dad had us racing go-karts when we were 8 or 9 and, you know, watched him race Formula Vs and Super Vs our whole lives. And my family owns a go-kart track now that has a lot of, I would say, higher level guys who come there to practice. And Santino Ferrucci, as you know, has owned it before my family bought it. So, you know, I'm a racing enthusiast, you know, love the sound of the cars, love the look of the cars, love hard driving and good racing. And, you know, even the business side of it's pretty cool, but that's, I guess, kind of my background. I think one of our neighbors knows about my passion for racing, and his son is dating a girl whose father has a house out there in Thermal. So he got an invite to go out there himself to see his son and his son's girlfriend, and he was allowed to bring a guest. So he came over and said, "Hey, do you want to go to this cool IndyCar event with me?" And it, you know, took about 2 seconds, and I said, "Sure, you know, I'm in." You know, go to Palm Springs and get to see these guys rip around in a really kind of overall VIP private experience. So I was pretty excited. That was probably 2 months ago, so I've been kind of waiting for this weekend for a long time.
So, when did you get there? How much time did you spend at the track?
So we flew in early. Probably got there about 10 in the morning on Friday. So I think first practice was probably already going. We probably missed that, but got to the house and walked out on the deck and literally was standing 30 yards away from the turn 9, the sweeping left-hander. Couldn't believe it, really. I mean, it was breathtaking view. There's, you know, that turn, I don't know if you watch it on TV, is pretty big, long, wide, sweeping lefty, and there's houses almost all the way around it. And we were kind of in the, I would say about the first quarter of the turn right there next to the track. My room had 30-foot glass windows that looked out onto the track. It was unreal.
Yeah.
It was a pretty unique experience.
I'm picturing just like the sounds of engines echoing through the entire house. If you're basically parked on the house, I mean, is parked basically right off the corner.
Yeah. It felt like some of those tracks, old tracks over in Europe where the houses were right up against the tracks. And as the sport grew and, you know, they were sort of this maybe antiquated farmhouse that was sitting on the edge of a track where it never should be. It felt like that, but modern.
So what was that like? I mean, I guess how often were you out of the house exploring the amenities, you know, the other people there, were they IndyCar fans? Were they just motorsport enthusiasts? Do they just, you know, people with a lot of money who like fast cars?
It was a mix. We kind of had a routine because of where we were situated. You had to get in the car and drive on the outside of the track. And then we'd enter the pit area. So it was about maybe a 4 or 5 minute drive to get there. We'd park on what originally is or normally is their go-kart track is what they used as a parking lot. And then we had to walk in. As we walked in to our left, which was kind of between, I would say, turn 14 and 15, that long straightaway, that's where all the transporters were lined up. And I mean, the access was, I mean, you were basically walking in among the teams. They kind of had, I would say, makeshift setups just because maybe they didn't expect that many fans. So they didn't kind of coordinate off as much as you'd expect normally. So you're really walking, and the team members and the drivers and everybody are kind of walking in the same places as all the fans or the guests. So we'd walk through that, which was really cool. You could see everybody. And then as you got to the end of that, which was, there was a hospitality area inside of turns 15 and 16. And that was kind of, we'd go there, we'd have lunch, sit there and watch some cars go by through that last turn before they went into the pits. And then we'd usually try and get back to the house in time to watch any kind of more serious racing aside from the practice, because the view from up there was pretty good.
Did you guys have like closed circuit TV and scoring and everything, or was it just laptops like we do, looking at your apps?
They sent out an email to the members with a link that was sort of a private feed that they asked you not to share outside of the track. So we had that, but then I really used the Indy app, the IndyCar app most of the time. It was about 30 seconds off, but it was still just really helpful to have that on. And we had the broadcast on the TV when, the stuff that they actually did broadcast on either Peacock or NBC. So it was it was almost like that F1 experience when you're above the pits in those really high end paddock suites, and you're kind of half watching some of the race on TV, and you have all the data, but you can literally take four steps one way and the cars are right there. So it was super cool experience. You can kind of get either side of it. We did a little bit of both. Your question as far as who was there, it seemed like, I don't know how many members Thermal Club has, but it was mostly members and their guests, media, IndyCar teams, IndyCar workers. There weren't a lot of just general spectators. You had a certain color badge. It was a red badge if you were a member guest. And I would say 90% of the people I saw either were hard carded or had the member guest badge.
Yeah, the impression I got watching on TV, I followed the testing loosely and everything, but the whole weekend was less about the shootout on Sunday morning, the race for the cash prize, as much as it was almost like showcasing IndyCar as a series and as a brand to, I would imagine, potential investors, whether that be in teams, sponsors, whatever it may be, investors in the series itself. Did you get that impression as well, or?
I did, I think, and even in some articles I read before I went there and since, it seemed like, was it Mark Miles? Is he the big wig there at Indy? So he kind of mentioned that exactly, just looking to build new relationships and partnerships. And, I think the buy-in, I'm not exactly sure. You hear a lot of different things, and I never, obviously wasn't going to be that sort of, direct with the gentleman hosting me who was there. The buy-in's substantial, and those guys have a lot of money. And they're obviously racing enthusiasts. So yeah, I think IndyCar would be beneficial to them to kind of fish in that pond. And I think it went the other way too, though. A lot of people kind of felt like it was a big commercial for the Thermal Club, just sort of, maybe they're looking to change their business model and attract, maybe you don't have to own a house, or maybe, you can be a car enthusiast and maybe they're going to have some public or generally more accessible garages where you can keep the car and come and race and not have a $4 million house. So it seemed like it kind of went both ways. Well, kind of a win-win for both those guys.
Yeah, it seemed like a huge win for the fans that ventured in. I guess I read something. I think they estimated the number of paying fans at only like 250 people. And, the original ticket price was $2,000, but then they dropped it to $500. Actually, that seems like a pretty good deal, because they said that was all the food was free. I don't know if that included beer and alcohol and stuff like that, but I mean, short of where you find lodging around there, it seemed like an awesome thing for the fans to do if they just took the initiative to get there.
Yeah, there's all kinds of, cheap hotels around there. There's tons of golf courses and, La Quinta. There's just a bunch of different little towns right nearby where people could have stayed. $500 for that for the weekend would have been a great deal. I mean, it was, they had food trucks there. They had catered food. They had couple grandstands set up with jumbotrons so people could see what was going on. The access was the access to the track and the racing was almost scary close. Like, I sent a picture to Amy at one point and said, I am scary close right now. And it felt like somebody should be telling me to move back.
I love that,
because
though.
I've seen a lot of racing and go-karts when they hit and cars when they hit. There's no physics that's going to let you figure out where those things are going to eventually go. And it felt like I moved myself, because I just felt like I should not be standing here.
Well, I noticed there was a few people scattered around on the outside of some of these fast turns. And all there is like that Armco guardrail. There's no catch fence anywhere. So Nothing. The whole thing was kind of a throwback in that way.
I mean, when I was sitting, the first practice we saw was the second practice on Friday. We were sitting inside that turn 15, 16, and just kind of waiting for the cars to come out. We just got some food and I'm cracking open a Modelo, and literally the car went by and I was just like, holy shit, that's close. And, you know, again, I kind of look back to old racing, but Ras Casa, that, you know, that cafe in Monaco, like the 50s movies you see of that, that's what it felt like. Like you were literally sitting that close. And like you said, you know, 4 foot Armco, 3 foot Armco, about 12 feet of grass and some really pretty begonias. And that was it between you and the track. So it was, we walked down to turn 14, which was kind of my favorite part of the course. If when you came through the sweeper in nine where we were, it went, it kind of undulated. I don't know how much you could see on TV, but it undulated through these S's, like 11, 12, 13, and 14 was a bit of a hairpin. We went all the way down to 14 and watched them come down that winding, those S's. And you could get really close, you know, directly behind it on the kind of the where they came out to the Armco on the exit of it before they went down the straight, like 15 feet away from the car.
Wow.
So
yeah, that was a kind cool part of the
a little scary.
Cool part of the track. And then that last turn, I forget how many what's the number? 17? That little bump they were going over on the left side before they launched through that final turn, and like all over the exit curbs bouncing around. It didn't look like much runoff there either, man. And that,
oh no. Well, the way the place is set up, so they got three tracks, a green track, a blue track, and a red track, and they run them all separate, or they can. This, what those guys ran was like 3 point something miles, and they ran a combination of the red and the blue track. The transitions between the tracks were tough. And that's where, like, when you, the guys, there was a right-hander coming, number eight was a right-hander on the red track that then transitioned right where we were onto the blue track. And a lot of guys lost it right there. I don't know if you, that's kind of where, who's 28? I'm drawing a blank.
Erickson
backed in there. That's where the crash was during the race. There was just enough to unsettle the car. They were kind of, it would push them out to the left, and then they would have to get over to the right and then start the sweeper. And as the car got really unsettled and the guys were just getting really twitchy. And so I think the transition between the tracks looked really technical, really tough to manage. The bomb, and that other place that you just mentioned was another place where they were going kind of off the blue onto the red. And it just, I think it caused some problems for some guys.
Yeah. So I do want to talk about the competition itself, the heat races, and then the final, obviously. Just give us your thoughts on that. What was it like watching that in person? And I guess, what were your thoughts on the way they had it formatted with the two heats and then the 20 lap final with the halftime break and all that?
I mean, overall, to me, I feel like this place or what they did was a great test, but then they put this like quarter or half a cherry on top and tried to have this race at the end. And I feel like there was just concessions in every direction. And it's like, you know, the teams, it could have been a great test, and maybe they just come there and they test and they learn and they go home. And they felt like they needed to add this competitive part to it, and didn't seem really well thought out. I mean, I think I saw one pass, like one meaningful pass the whole weekend. And other things might've happened. We didn't have a view of what happened on the red track, which was the start finish line and kind of where that accident was in one. There was looked like some good passing zones there, but I think that last 10 lap, race was about the only time guys really went to battle. So, you know, when it first started and I saw how slow Herta was going, it's like, you know, it's hard because you get so many different ideas of what the rules are and who gets to do what and what's happening. You know, we're half paying it. It's not like we're living it and running a team. We're just kind of enjoying it, but also enthusiasts. And so at first I didn't realize they couldn't change tires. So, you know, the fact that there was no initiative for him to go fast at all, really smart on his part, but it just was kind of like, what are these 10 laps for?
Yeah, he wasn't the only one. Obviously, he took it to an extreme, right? By starting in the back anyway and just sort of lagging. But everybody was doing that, right? The whole thing must have just looked kind of like a ridiculous
once
parade.
Once Palau got out front, he just kind of soft-pedaled it. Once McLaughlin knew he couldn't catch him, he soft-pedaled it. And it was just like maintain and get to this little break. And then, and Herta was – that was smart. He said – I heard an interview with him after. He just said, I didn't have a car that could win from the get-go. So – I'll just save tires and go hard the last 10 and see if I can get up there and get a little bit of money. And I think he ended up fourth and probably got $100,000 out of it, which the money thing was weird too. I think, you know, they bill it as this $1 million race, and then the winner only got 500,000. And that's nothing to those guys. They spent more than that in tires, you know, to be there. And the guys who finished 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, whatever, got $23,000. I mean, it just seems
all like... All the way down. Yeah, $23,000 all the way down. The whole entire, I think, everybody who showed up, whether they made final or not, I think got the $23,000, I think. But yeah, you're right. I mean, $500,000 is a lot of money to put in your pocket, but I don't think that's the way it works, right? The budget for these teams just to get their cars out there, their travel budget, everything like that. And then if you throw in damage, you know, like happened to a few of the guys, yeah, $500,000 is a drop in the bucket. I mean, and I was talking to Michael right before this, the golf that was on at the same time, which is, I think, a mid-tier Valspar. I mean, it is PGA, but like a mid-level event. The winner of that basically has no expenses, right? It's got to pay for his coach and to get there, maybe his family. The winner of that got $1.5 million. So talking about the money, I think, is a little bit of a... I don't know. It doesn't really do it. It doesn't make you faster either as a driver. I guess if they, you know, if they threw in some huge number, maybe it would make you more reckless, but it wouldn't make you any faster.
Maybe more risk in setup or more risk in driving. But, you know, in a nutshell, I just felt like there wasn't enough racing and the racing that was there just wasn't good enough. Even there was one support race. They had the members drive these like probably tuned down NASCARs. Maybe I think there was maybe 12 of them. And I think it was before qualifying on Saturday. So they had one support race. Some of the guys looked like they could drive really well. And a couple guys were way off the back, probably looked like they had, you know, didn't have a ton of experience. It was just a big mixed bag, but it was cool to watch. But I would have loved, I know they have a BMW school there. They have a BMW track. They're a mini track. It seems like they could have showcased what they had to offer more, even give like, you know, rides to the guests and some of their, they have a whole fleet of M4s, stuff like that. It just didn't seem like there was much racing, on track stuff going on.
Did you get a chance to either ride around the track or walk the track late at night or anything like that?
I didn't, no.
That would have been an easy poach. That probably would have been an easy poach, though, right? Middle of the night, just jump on.
Would have been, you know, the guy that I was staying with probably had thousands of laps on it, and his daughter was with us also, and she's maybe, you know, probably got 500 laps on it, and so that was cool to get their perspective of what was going on. But I never got down on the track. When we got close enough, it looked really technical the way they had it set up. I mean, we were probably in the easiest part of the track, but it wasn't even easy because guys were kind of touching the inside, and there was a lot of stones. So if one guy would touch the inside and just bring all this stuff out onto the track, and the next 10 or 12 guys that went through were just hammering through these pretty big rocks almost. And then you could just see them getting loose. You could hear them just pounding the underside of the cars. Overall just beautiful facility, a nice, super high end VIP racing experience. I wouldn't probably go back though.
Yeah.
You know, for me, they'd have to offer a lot more to want to go back there.
Well, if they change the format, if they do go back and they change the format of the event itself, I mean, obviously they're there really mostly to test, right? But if they put a little more focus on the event, make it actually count and, you know, have it pay points at least, then depending on the format, I'd be into it. I'd like to go check that
out. Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, if I don't know what the formula is or what the carrot is for those guys, but to just make them race hard and want to win. And it just didn't seem like it. Once they figured out where they were, even in the last race with the 12 guys, they just seemed like they kind of knew about where they were going to finish, and nobody really drove that hard. The one thing that was kind of exciting was watching the qualifying races, those guys who were 6th, 7th, and 8th. Like Santino Ferrucci was an 8th, I think I can't remember his first or second race, but he was closing the gap on 7, trying to get there. And you could see a little bit of fighting for that last spot to get into the main event. And that was probably the most excitement of, as far as like, is this going to happen or not happen?
Yeah, that was I think Siegel was in 7th, which was pretty amazing in his, you know. And then Ferrucci ride on him. So yeah, when we go through some of we're still going to do a review like we normally do, even though there wasn't a lot of action. So we will get into some of that, but.
They had free ice cream too. They had an ice cream truck.
We heard a lot about that on TV.
It was so funny because you'd get there And if there was any break in the action where the teams had a second, like the ice cream line was like 40 deep, all the team guys were really into the into the ice cream, and they had some pretty good food trucks. I think the teams probably had a great time. They treated the teams really well. I think I would guess for the most part the teams probably enjoyed it.
So was it hot? I mean, kind of curious about the weather because it looked really calm and sunny one minute, and then all of a sudden, like this huge wind would kick up out of nowhere and throw dust around. And I couldn't tell if there was a temperature change or what, but it looked like kind of crazy weather.
Yeah, day one was hot. It was probably close to 90, I would guess, and a perfect temperature, not a cloud in the sky, no wind. It was really super nice day. The next day, it started to cool off a little bit. It wasn't cold, but the wind definitely would pick up. I mean, you could get it's out in the middle of nowhere. It's just totally flat and it's desert. So it's super dusty, and you know, there was a lot of like Saturday night, the winds had to be 70 miles an hour. I swear that I thought the windows were going to blow in on the place we were staying, and just, you know, all the teams had to take down their tents, and I mean, it probably wreaked havoc on them pretty bad, but the track definitely was, I think, tougher to drive because of all the dirt that was getting kicked up on it.
Yeah, it also seemed like the wind was almost unpredictable. I mean, they talked about it a little bit, but, you know, out of nowhere, one lap it looked like it would be calm, and the next lap, this huge wind, a couple times at least, it looked like it came out of nowhere. Man, that could really, you know, change the way your car gets around a corner and get dangerous. But
I'm surprised it didn't affect it more. I mean, it was like exactly what you said, just getting a huge tailwind from the back and lightning in the rear, or just changing the balance. I thought for sure a couple of times, like that turn 15 after the long straight after the S's and 14, the wind seemed to kind of come from behind them there. And I thought, I mean, there was a couple sessions where guys were three or four guys in a row would get really wide on that turn. And I think that was probably what it was doing. And then in that big sweeper, I thought we'd see a little more unsettled cars because of the wind, but they seemed to handle it pretty well. Yeah. Then a chunk of the track came up at one point. Heard a you know, ran over something, and I don't know if that was because of the heat or if it was exactly what happened. They patched it with some quick dry epoxy, I think. But then in the middle of the night, I looked out the window and they had that whole area lit up, and then apparently they dug down about 18 inches. I don't know if they talked about any of this on the broadcast, but they dug down about 18 inches for about 50 feet and replaced the whole section of the track in the middle of the night. And apparently it was done really well. So I mean, kudos to that place. They seemed like they wanted to make sure the drivers had a good track to drive on.
All right. Well, hey, Jeff, thanks for joining us, man.
I appreciate it. I hope there was some insights that were meaningful. You know, it's hard to kind of take it all in and be there as a fan and not really thinking, you know, about the sort of the business side of it. But I've read a lot of the social media stuff after, and it seems like it's, to me, like 80%, 75% negative. You know, I don't know what you guys are seeing, or just elitist, bad format, things like that. But a lot of good things about the track, and the drivers thought it was super technical. So I think there's pieces of it that are there that could make it great. They just got to make some tweaks.
There's always negative stuff and definitely a lot of negativity around this event, but we try to keep it positive in general, just because that's the way we roll.
Yeah, and I like that.
We're happy there's a race rather than no race. So that's good. But we definitely have some ideas about what they could do to make it better.
Yeah. Like you said earlier, it was like the race itself seemed like a half cherry on top. I feel like that was the perfect way to put it. But I think there's a lot to build on here. If Thermal keeps having IndyCar back, if IndyCar wants to keep going back, and they want to do this blended testing, but also showcase IndyCar competition a little bit, I think they can do it. I just think they have to, for the competition part, they've got to find something that actually showcases IndyCar racing. You know, IndyCar fans all know IndyCar as being just like one of the most outright exciting racing series there is. And I just don't know that that was really fully on display with the way they had the competition formatted.
I agree 100% with you. Like, I think almost any weekend, any of these guys can win and battle, and the cars they are and the drivers they are. And it did not showcase that at all. I mean, it was it just almost felt more like Formula One with the gaps between first and second. Once people got out, got going, it was, and it could be the track. You know, the guy that we were staying with just said it's a really tough track to pass on. He said, I know it may not look like it, but he said it's narrow, and as fast as these guys are going, even though they don't have some of the aero issues that F1 has, he said it's going to be tough for these guys to find places to pass. And I think he was right. You know, he knew that stuff. Yep. Anyway, well, I appreciate you guys including me, and good luck with the rest of it. Can't wait to listen.
Awesome, man. Happy Easter.
Same to you guys. Ciao.
All right. That was awesome. It's fun to hear from Hannon, who was there, and, you know, obviously knows his stuff, knows what to look for.
Great to hear from somebody who was there. Yeah. And you and I know him personally, obviously. So we know that he knows his stuff when it comes to racing. Interesting though. I mean, it does sound like the impression I got from him was sort of what I expected, which is that very impressive as a test weekend, great test track. And it sounds like the Thermal Club members were enthused to have IndyCar there. But like we saw on TV, even there, the competition part of it fell a little bit flat. But I do think that there's a lot to build on if they want to keep doing this.
Yeah, I agree. So I've got a couple of suggestions here that are kind of, I think, would be easy fixes. So, and some of these may sound like complaints, not just suggestions, but first of all, make sure the betting sites put odds up. I could not find anywhere to bet. My normal Bovada wouldn't do it. Nobody had odds up. So if it's your marketing department deciding to budget something to pay these bookmakers to put odds up, do it. And that's people respond to that. Everybody's got an app now and they want to throw around bets, even if it's $1, whatever. So make sure that your odds are appearing on all the big websites, and maybe even pay a little extra so that these online bookmakers feature your events. I think that would immediately, you know, potentially add a lot of viewers and at least bring the interest level up. So that's one thing I think they ought to do. You know, they keep talking about push to pass and all this emphasis on push to pass. I don't think it was that big of a factor. I feel like in this case, just give them full horsepower or give them more horsepower than normal. I don't know what the specs are, if that's going to burn up your engines or what, but the whole push to pass and talking about, you know, don't let the guy behind use push to pass, but then who's behind him? It's just going to get way too complicated. Just get rid of it.
Yeah.
Or
give them more of it. I mean,
give them more of it. Change the name.
Like we've said before, it's really just, it's not even push to pass. It's just a turbo boost button. It turns their turbo up temporarily. So it's used to pass. It's used to block. It's used to set a fast in lap or out lap or fast qualifying lap or something. And IndyCar's had, you know, they used to be able to just adjust their turbos mid race to, I don't know exactly how that worked, but I don't think they necessarily need to get rid of it, but I just think calling it push to pass again is a marketing miss. It's just a turbo boost button.
Exactly. So stopping the race in the middle and calling it halftime, I mean, that's just like NASCAR bullshit. And so I don't know what they thought was going to happen, but I figured, I was not surprised when Herta did. They were talking about it before the race. People are going to baby their tires and creep around. What they should do is make the race long enough so that everybody needs the pit.
Yeah.
And potentially make them use, you know, there's two compounds, make them use each compound. So right off the bat, you'd have different strategies. People might light fill at the very start, or they, who knows what they'll do. But you're not going to have this trumped up, you know, reset the field and all that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, the halftime bit seemed a little half-baked. I don't know why they threw it in there, truthfully. Maybe it was just to bunch up the field and get a restart, but then the no changing tire rules and everything, it just kind of sounded like they slapped some ideas together and went for it and didn't really consider what the product might actually look like when they go to run it, you know, what the teams might come up with.
I heard a good one. I think this might have come from Colton Herta on qualifying. One car at a time. You start from a standing start at pit out, and you race to the you know how they had the alternate timing and scoring right before the start finish line. So standing start from pit out, race to the timing line.
Yeah,
to come into the pits. You got one shot at it, and you just rapid fire.
Yeah.
So when one guy's done, the next guy's goes, and that's, you know.
You can do that Sunday morning before the race starts too. You don't have to do that Saturday night.
Yeah. So that's just a kind of an off the wall idea that I thought could be interesting. The heat races. Now those could be split into two and maybe they're just five laps each, but you award points to the leader at the stoppage and then reverse the order. And then, so whoever finishes the first half in the lead goes to the back and you flip. So you just basically invert the order and then you add up the two, wherever they finish at the end, they earn points and you just add up their total points for the heat.
Yeah.
That's one way that you would definitely get some passing going.
Well, I think we're kind of just trashing the format right now without, we're just kind of trashing the format. But the thing is with not awarding points, you can get really creative with the format. So yeah.
Well, wait, hold on. I'm not just trashing the format. I've actually thought this through. I read this. Somebody else suggested this. These aren't points that would go to the championship. These are just points to get out of the heat.
Yeah.
So you qualify, whatever. Let's say you lead your heat to the green. It's 10 lapper. After five laps, they yellow it. Just reset the, or you don't even have to come into the pits. Just reset the order and throw the green again. And then you total up the points from the first half of the race and the points in the second half of the race. That wouldn't take really any more time.
Yeah.
And that's one way to, it's a little trumped up, but that is one way to create, if they're looking for some trumped up excitement, I think that would do it.
Yeah. I mean, again, with no points being awarded, no championship points, I think you could even do a random draw for starting order. We could get some guys that really don't belong at the front, just up at the front fighting for a good finish, a chance to show off a little bit, finishing positions they don't usually get. I just think there's a lot of things they can do, and it does seem like what they came up with was sort of half-baked.
I also don't see why the main heat needs to be reduced to 12 cars. Why not let everybody in it? Not sure what's gained by reducing. I guess the heat race has become more important for sixth place, obviously. So
yeah,
there is some validity to that, but maybe you just increase the number. I think 12 cars, only 10 cars started the second part of that race.
Yeah.
Because of disqualifications and stuck throttle. So kind of what all I got for it. So.
Well, I just think you could do, I didn't really think this through about what specifically I would change. I actually really like that idea of just launching from pit out for your qualifying lap and then coming around to the alternate start finish. And then as soon as you cross it, send the next guy out and you could rapid fire qualifying and then just line people up for your heat races. But they can mess around with this. I mean, I think if they're going to come back, they can look at inverting the field. They could change the heat race formats. I sort of like your idea of just yellow flag, re-rack, go again. You don't need to have this 10-minute halftime break or anything. You could do random draws for heat races and average best finishing positions or something to set the final. I really think they have a solid foundation to build on. I also think it might make a little bit more sense intuitively if it was a preseason event. I understand they were trying to fill this gap in the calendar, but if you do this, if you come up with a cool format, you get a full testing weekend in front of potential investors before the IndyCar season starts. And then you come up with some really cool, exciting format for Sunday where there's actual competition. And if it works, if the format does a good job of showcasing IndyCar racing, then you get everybody fired up for the first race of the year, which I imagine would still be St. Pete.
All right, so let's do our race review.
Yeah, so real quick, I think we should just review the format as it was now that we've let it rip a little bit. Two qualifying groups set by random draw. These ran on Saturday night and they set the grids for the heat races, which would then set the starting order for the final. So the two heats were just 10 laps or 20 minutes, whatever came first. Yellow laps don't count and the top six transfer on. Everyone from seventh on back, that's the end of their day. So that gives us 12 cars for the final race, which was 20 laps. Again, yellow flag laps don't count. There was a 10-minute halfway break at lap 10 where refueling was allowed, but no tire changing and some other, I think there were some other specific rules in there about being allowed to adjust wing angle and whatnot and tend to the driver. But that is the format that we were racing under on Sunday. So qualifying results for group one, you had Rosenqvist put the car on pole. Again, showing very fast. McLaughlin right there with him. VK, Lundgaard, Newgarden, Grosjean was just outside of starting, just outside of the transfer spot in seventh looking in. Canepino outside looking in. Dixon outside looking in. Herta all the way back in 11th, way outside looking in. So he goes into this heat race knowing that he's going to have some work to do. Same with Kirkwood. And then you've got guys like Siegel and Stingray Rob starting back there as well. But most notably, you know, Rosenquist and McLaughlin, front row, they lead the field to the start of the first heat.
There's some great in cars. Again, if you go to the IndyCar website and check out the extended onboards, you get some killer views of the start. Herta starts at 11th, like you said. He kind of hangs back. He's got Siegel next to him, and he times it just right and gets a huge jump, and so dives to the inside of Dixon, and then Dixon sort of gives him a little chop. Herta backs off and cuts in. They barely touch. Herta's right front wing lightly touches Dixon's left rear, and then we all know Dixon was a little late on the brakes, or Grosjean or whoever in front was early on the brakes, or probably some combo where Dixon gets into the back of Grosjean and, you know, launches him across the curbing and smacks into VK. Right off the bat, you know, we got some frustration.
Yeah, so Grosjean jumped out and was very upset and said, you know, who's going to pay for this crash damage and everything? I think he was upset about not just being taken out, but the whole circumstances they were racing under. I will say about the start, it looked like a go-kart start. I think without all the grandstands around the track and everything, it almost looks like a giant go-kart track. And it was a tight start. It was really close quarters. So it almost looks like it looked like a lot of the LO206 go-kart starts that I'm in at Newcastle. You know, I was in a couple summers ago. But yeah, like you said, so Grosjean gets hooked. I think the big loser, obviously Grosjean, big loser, VK, big loser because they collide. VK, wrong place, wrong time. But Power, who started inside the top six, so just at the end of the knockout position, I guess, has to go way wide to avoid this. So he's sort of a big loser in this as well. And Dixon gets penalized for the move, which I think is fair. So his chances of transferring basically end right there.
Lundgaard gets tagged by VK after the contact. So his left side pod took some damage, and that may have affected him for the rest of the day. He was allowed to put a little bit of tape on it, but that's about it. And Kirkwood, I was watching the in-car from Kirkwood's car, started in 13th, and he swung to the outside, and I was, you know, they had the nose cam on, and he just, when Ferrucci, who was also on the outside, trying to, there was a couple of different lines actually through that turn for the opening lap. So guys were going, you know, you could go through there too wide at the start. And Ferrucci had to hit the binders as Power straight lined it, like you've said, to avoid. And then Kirkwood tagged him from behind. You could see the camera broke and then fell out. So he had nose cone damage. But they stayed green for a few more turns, and the racing was kind of ferocious up front.
Yeah. I mean,
McLaughlin and Rosenquist were going at it really hard. It was pretty intense, and Rosenquist ended up getting the spot away, and then they threw the yellow. But I thought they could have kept the green out for another, you know, I'm not that familiar with the track, so I don't know exactly where they were, but I don't even think they were halfway around yet. So they could have left the green up for a few more turns, but they didn't. So we go yellow.
I think that may have put us on the 20-minute clock. It did, because we only do 8 laps by the end of this, 8 green flag laps, that is, by the end of this. So we don't even get the full 10. But so Power being sent wide, he didn't get any damage, but that sort of set up some intrigue for the rest of this race, because he qualified in the fast 6, so you'd imagine he's got pace to transfer, but now he's got guys to pass in a very limited amount of time to do it. So he, on the restart, he gets by Stingray Rob fairly easily, and then has actually a great battle with Kirkwood. But like Hannon said in his interview, the battle for the transfer spot was pretty interesting, actually. Herta was in it, and he had 4 cars, I think three specifically behind him after Power had gotten around Kirkwood. It was Herta 6 and Siegel just on the outside looking in. Ferrucci behind him, who was actually challenging Siegel for that spot. And then Power caught up to those guys as well, and we know he had pace. You know, it's not like nothing happened in these heat races, I will say. And all the while, McLaughlin was really hounding Rosenquist for the lead.
Yeah, but Siegel pretty impressive in seventh and really close to Herta. Never really had a chance to make a pass, and that's the way it ended. So Siegel, Kirkwood, Ferrucci, Stingray, Will Power, and Dixon all get eliminated.
Yep. And so that leaves Rosenquist, McLaughlin, Newgarden, Lundgaard, Canepino, and Herta moving on to the final.
Okay, so Heat 2, I thought on paper, looked a little more interesting, and it kind of played out that way. And it's mainly because all three McLarens were in it.
Yeah.
And they were starting 7th, 8th, and 9th. And it was kind of strange because they had all been fast in the testing and had put up good laps. And I think Ilott led one of the sessions, and Rossi was up there every time. During their qualifying session, though, I think those guys might have all three been up near the front, and then it was red flagged. And so they gave everybody one more flyer lap, and none of them took it. None of the McLarens went back out. At least Ilott didn't go, and Rossi didn't go. I forget if O'Ward did or not. So they all got shuffled back because everybody put up their best laps. And so the McLarens all started together 7th, 8th, and 9th. I thought that was kind of awesome.
Yeah, I agree. And they had directly in front of them, they had Pietro Fittipaldi 6th, Blomqvist 5th, Lundqvist 4th. I mean, these guys really don't have a lot of experience running that high in the running order and running ahead of the McLarens, to be honest. This is starting up there is a great opportunity for them to hang on and try to get into this transfer spot. And meanwhile, you've got the McLarens flying in formation, so they've got to fight each other to, you imagine only one or two is probably going to, maybe all three can transfer, but it's going to be hard to get all three of them in there. So they've got to fight hard with each other, and they've also got to fight hard with the guys ahead of them to get in. So that's probably a little nerve-wracking. I mean, it wasn't a points-paying race, but still, you don't want to be the one McLaren that gets knocked out.
No, usually when you got these teammates all running together, I've heard you say flying in formation a lot. It's a very good description, but not in this circumstance because they were kind of dogfighting each other.
They were totally dogfighting.
I mean, Rossi was really good all weekend. He was fun to watch. And with Ilott trying to beat his two teammates and, sort of establish himself as the top candidate for a seat, he ended up passing Rossi at the start.
Yeah.
And then they went too wide through a couple different turns, and then Rossi went off into the grass and there was into the dirt. There was no grass around there, a lot of dirt. They were really dicing each other up.
Yeah, almost looked like a crash a couple times. Like you said, Ilott got around Rossi on the start. I think he actually ran into the back of Blomqvist, like right front wing to left rear tire or something.
Did.
Rossi did that, yeah. But anyways, like you said, Rossi did wind up getting back around. O'Ward gets Ilott as well. And then the fight's on to get the transfer spot. Rossi winds up getting Blomqvist, but Blomqvist trying to hang out, trying to hang around the outside, kind of gets pushed wide, winds up losing out to O'Ward as well. So these guys were racing each other really hard.
I thought the best racing of the whole weekend was actually the McLaren cars racing each other in that first heat race, or heat race number two, I should say.
Yeah. I also thought that Ericsson might be able to move up a little bit because he started back there, didn't post a qualifying time. I assume that was that the red flag. I didn't get to see qualifying on Saturday.
I forget.
I think it may have been the red flag because I think they showed the replay of him backing into the wall. So if he caused the red flag, he would have had the time pulled, which explains why he started at the back. But I thought he'd make a little bit of a charge. He was held up by Kiffin Simpson. Simpson did a good job of defending. But I mean, that was mostly it. Pillow and Armstrong kind of just streaked away at the front of this one.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned Pillow yet in this entire podcast, and he just is pretty untouchable.
Yeah.
And I guess we didn't really know how untouchable yet, but he looked good in this heat. Armstrong was the only guy that really could challenge, and even he couldn't stay with him. And then there was a little bit of a gap in Rahal in third, Lundqvist behind him in fourth, Fittipaldi in fifth. And once Rossi got into sixth, I mean, all three of those guys were content to just hold position. Nobody was going to jeopardize anything. Rossi just had to make sure that he could keep O'Ward behind him. And actually, Pato was not really even close on that final lap. So I think toward the end of that thing, it settled down and they all just sort of held station and made it to the final. So yeah, O'Ward gets eliminated, and Blomqvist, Ilott, Rasmussen, Kiffin Simpson, Marcus Erickson, and Colin Brown.
And Pelot, Armstrong, Rahal, Lundqvist, Fittipaldi, and Rossi all transfer.
All right, so that takes us to the main event.
The money race. So our grid, so they offset, I think it was heat one set the inside, heat two set the outside row, or vice versa. So we have Pelot, Rosenqvist, Armstrong, McLaughlin, Rahal, Newgard, and Lundqvist, Fittipaldi, Canepino, Rossi, Lundgard, Herta, the 12 guys who start the final.
So great start for McLaughlin. He goes from P4 up to second. Got a good jump on Armstrong, who had started to his inside, and then he went around the outside of Rosenqvist in turn one, and so settled into the second place. And I didn't see a whole lot else outside of that.
Well, right off the bat, Herta dropped off the pace, tire saving right away. So they talked about, on TV, they talked about teams having talked amongst themselves about possibly doing this, but we saw right from the get-go that Herta was going for it. Canepino is starting back there too. It looked like he visibly started to save tire and back way off on lap two. And then sort of bizarrely, they told Pietro Fittipaldi to start saving fuel on lap three. So I don't really know how you mess up the fueling for such a short race, but he winds up dropping all the way back to 10th.
So that was sort of odd because, you know, that race was, that first part of that race was so weird. I ended up staying on Fittipaldi's in car almost the whole time because he was in shock. He's like, wait, what? You didn't get enough fuel in there? Tell, you know, give me the number. And then I guess there was a rule that if you get lapped, you're eliminated. So he had fallen, you know, as the race was, as the first 10 laps were unfolding, he had fallen behind Herta because he really, really had to save. And he kept asking his team for the gap and they weren't answering because I don't know if they, it wasn't on their electronics. He wanted the gap from him back to the leader to see how much room he had before he was going to get lapped. And they wouldn't answer him. They didn't know. Timing and scoring doesn't show it that way, right? So eventually they said, okay, you got about 20 seconds. It was really, really interesting because I thought he wasn't going to make it on fuel.
Yeah.
He finally does. And then he pulls in and they disqualify him anyway.
Yeah.
For not loading the tank. So I didn't really understand what the officiating was there. I figured if they wanted everybody to have a full tank, I would think that IndyCar would fill the tank, not the teams.
Yeah.
Maybe they were trying to use less fuel or to go lighter to put less wear on the tire. I have no idea. Obviously it was a mistake, but for him to have to go through all that and actually stay on the lead lap and nurse the car all the way to the end and then, you know, not be able to start the second half was a little bit of a slap, especially since Rahal had stuck throttle and had to pull in halfway through the first part. And so he was unable to get back out. And Lundgaard was never able to repair his side pod damage. So even though Rahal, Letterman, Lanigan, you know, had, I'd say, a pretty good showing. Yeah, all three cars making the main heat, but a little bit tough deal.
It was a disaster, really. I mean, they got all three of them in, and then they all, well, Rahal dropped out with the mechanical. Fittipaldi got disqualified, and Lundgaard had the damage, so.
Yeah, I mean, no other team got all their cars in.
Yeah.
Penske didn't get them all in.
Yeah.
Andretti didn't get them in, and neither did Ganassi. So that was a little bit of an accomplishment, but yeah, sort of a letdown. Yeah.
But so anyways, the first 10 laps, the first half, the run to halfway is really marked by tire saving. I mean, I think everybody by about lap five was doing it. I think the cameras were mostly pointed at what was going on with Fittipaldi, but then also the leaders, but you could just see the gaps grow and grow and grow. Herta is the most extreme example, having done it from lap one, but I think pretty soon everybody was like, well, it makes a lot more sense to just save our tires and get to this second half than rather than try to burn them off and start fighting. So actually, I think that played into Pelot's favor because that goes all the way up to the front, which allows Pelot to back off and drive a little bit smoother, drive it about 80 or 90% rather than 100 and save his tires. And we know how good he is at that. So I think actually that may have helped him out a little bit.
Yeah, so they pull them all in, they refuel, they're not allowed to touch the tires, and we go out and start single file. The running order at the restart was Pelot, McLaughlin, Rosenquist, Armstrong, Newgarden, Lundquist, Rossi, Canepino, Herta in ninth, and then Lundgaard, they moved him back to the back because I guess he made some repairs to the side pod. Rahal was unable to restart. Fittipaldi unable to restart. So they go green, and right off the bat, Rossi's making moves. He gets around Lundquist, starts the battle with Newgarden.
Two are really going wheel to wheel, and they actually go off course.
Rossi had gotten half a car length ahead of Newgarden and started pinching him to the right. And so they both early apex that like double right-hander, and they might have made light contact with each other. Either way, they both, you know, shot off the left side of the track, gathered it back up. But Herta had gone by and Lundquist had gone by, so they really kind of hurt themselves there.
They give up two spots doing that. So, yeah, like you said, Rossi was looking really fast. I do think, though, maybe not everyone, but I at least was watching Herta because we knew he was going to have the freshest tires. Very curious to see how the tire save was going to pay off. And Rossi and Newgarden going off like that, that got Herta up to sixth almost, not instantaneously, but two laps into this second half of the race. And then Herta is able to grab P5 from Lundquist with what, if you remember, was a late move on Lundquist. I mean, I think for Linus to leave the door open was excellent racecraft, because if he had come down on what was otherwise the normal racing line, probably would have been a crash. So that gets Herta up to fifth, and that drops Lundquist to sixth with Rossi, who's now recovered. And these two also have a really good battle. This sees Rossi lunging it up the inside of, I forget which turn, but then overshooting and having to gather it back up and losing the position again. Yeah, the guys were going at it.
And then Herta just sort of, you know, made a kind of a casual pass almost on Armstrong, made it look easy, and was up to fourth. That's where it ended.
Yep, that's our last change of position during this race with three laps to go. And Pillow, I mean, really just walks right into a nice $500,000 win.
Yeah, so let's go down the order. I don't know what else to say about Pillow. He just dominated. I mean, this was a driver's track, right? He was untouchable. Yeah, so he walks away with the money. McLaughlin looked good the whole time, too. You know, a couple of aggressive moves, got into second at the start, and was able to, clear Rosenquist and never really get any pressure from behind.
Yeah, and Rosenquist, though, also great race, great event. We really didn't see much of him in the second half. I think he was kind of right where he belonged in third, but that's a really good result.
Yeah, I mean, he's building off what he did in St. Pete. He got the pole for the first heat, and he got third place overall. So off to a really good start.
Yep, so Herta comes up to fourth. A great use of tire save in the first half to set him up for a charge. Really, he was the story of the second half of the final heat.
I was surprised because I'd spent some time on his in car in the race in the first race, and he was barely holding on to sixth. And like I said, he had Siegel on him. And at the end of the race, after he crossed the line, he was like, "My fucking hands are killing me." So I didn't think he was going to make it through, 20 laps. That was just a 10 lap thing. So I don't know if there was ran over some curbs or something that kind of jarred his hands. But I had sort of written him off just because of that one comment that I randomly overheard.
Yeah.
But he obviously conserved not just tire the first 10 laps, but maybe he conserved physically. And that might have helped him in the second half of that thing. So
could be. Armstrong gets fifth. Excellent result.
Lundquist right behind him. I would say that I wouldn't call it a surprise, but, being a rookie, I think he showed really well. I think he outperformed a lot of the veterans over the course of this event.
Yeah, so Rossi ultimately winds up in seventh, but probably the most exciting driver in the final. It certainly looked like he was doing everything he could to get up to the front.
Yeah, I love the team warfare in the, race two or heat one, whatever, the second group. That was awesome.
Yep.
Newgarden ends up in eighth, probably a little frustrated. I mean, he was running in fifth when Rossi made sort of the, had gotten a half a car length on him and sort of cost him a couple spots. So, but he looked pretty calm after that. You know, I was watching his in car and he had a couple chances to run right up under Rossi's tire at the apex and just didn't do it. Probably figured he wasn't going to win at this point. No point in getting any crash damage. No points to be gained. So I think he just chilled out basically the last five laps of this race.
Yep.
That leaves Lundgaard in ninth. Hard to tell with Lundgaard. He got that side pod damage on the opening corner of the first heat. You know, he had looked good in all the testing, and I think he started that heat. Where did he start that heat? Fourth.
Yep.
So I don't know. It's hard to know if that damage caused, I'm sure it had an effect, right? I mean, punched a big hole in the side pod. They had to tape it up. So he was driving with a damaged car, probably just happy to bring it home in one piece. It probably just didn't feel that good. So brought it home in ninth, and then Canepino in 10th, you know, looked great in his earlier heat, but just didn't show very well in that final.
It looked like he went into heavy tire save early in the first half of the race, but then didn't really show anything for it in the second half. But I think it was a good result for that team to get in, got the team and the sponsors a little bit of extra TV time.
Yeah, and they'd already had one of their cars, you know, with a bunch of damage, so there wasn't much point in just chucking it all to gain a spot that really doesn't pay any points or any more money. That's the main heat. And then how are we going to go through the rest of these? It's going to be a little confusing. I guess let's go with...
We could just go with the cuts from one and then two.
All right.
So Siegel is the first car to get cut out of heat race number one. He was right there hanging with Herta, like you said. I don't know if he ever really challenged for the final spot wheel to wheel, but he never really dropped back, although he did have, I think by the end, he was more fending off Ferrucci than he was trying to hang with Herta.
Yeah, but that says a lot right there, right? He's within striking distance of Herta, and he's fending off Ferrucci, and it's his first IndyCar start. I would say that he showed really, really well, and I'm sure it helped that he had 9 hours of testing.
Yeah.
Enough time to get comfortable, but yeah, I look forward to seeing him get back in the car. I think it's Long Beach. All right, behind Siegel, we had Santino. He got hit from behind on the very first corner of heat race number one. Like I said, he had to check up when power, you know, shot around to the outside to avoid. And so he lost a few spots there and was just never able to regain them.
And then Kirkwood, I just didn't really think had much pace, sort of surprising lack of pace, actually.
Yeah, he qualified 13th. I'm not sure. I don't remember the circumstances there. And I don't remember exactly how he slotted in during the test sessions. But yeah, he got that nose damage the very beginning of the heat when he bumped into the back of Ferrucci. It punched a hole in his nose. So that definitely hurt him. But yeah, he won Long Beach last year, so he's probably looking forward to moving on from this. Did we mention power? I guess we did, that he had to go wide and avoid, but was unable to recover, finished the first heat in ninth. And then Stingray ends up 11th. You know, he was kind of at the back, I guess most of the sessions at the back, but he did get a couple spots at the start of this and fought power hard and held him off for a couple laps, but then drops behind. And then Scott Dixon, after the penalty, ends up last in that first heat.
Yeah, and then the DNFs obviously are VK and Grosjean, neither of which really are at fault here. They're both sort of just wrong place, wrong time.
I did feel bad for those guys, and Grosjean was, you know, he's just an emotional guy, and he was pissed.
Yeah, and he's trying to finish races. I mean, I know this isn't a points race, but still, he probably wants to get on a streak of finishing.
Yeah, and then VK, kind of a bummer, because I would have loved to see what he could have done in an event like this. I think he's the kind of guy that would be, like we always say, he's fun to watch and makes things happen. So that was a shame to lose both of those guys.
Yeah, he was starting third, so really should have been able to transfer pretty easily from there, I would think. So I think it would have been cool to have him in the final. Just wasn't meant to be, I guess.
All right, so heat race two, O'Ward is the first guy who did not transfer. A little surprising, I guess, that he didn't easily make that main event. But like I said, McLaren, it was weird during qualifying that they opted to not go back out and run that final lap. Maybe it was all about, you know, protecting tires, or maybe didn't have any push to pass remaining, but put him in a tough starting spot. He spent the whole first half of that heat fighting his teammates, probably just didn't have much left, you know, as far as tire at the end of that. So didn't have anything for Rossi and ends up seventh out.
Yep. Blomqvist is the next one to get knocked out. He did start in a transfer position fifth, I want to say.
Yeah, he started fifth. He got tapped at the exit of turn one, like you said, on the opening lap. Just a light tap from Rossi was able to gather it up. I think it actually hurt Rossi more than it hurt Blomqvist. It hurt Rossi's exit speed, and that's what allowed Ilott to get around the outside. But, yeah, I'd say he had a pretty good race. I mean, tough to fend off those McLarens, right?
Yeah, great wheel-to-wheel fighting, though. I mean, I imagine that's still pretty fun behind the wheel, even if you come out on the losing end. And I also just think, I mean, he's a very experienced race car driver, you know, an experienced driver, but in a new series. And I just think, you know, in IndyCar, although he's raced, you know, high-performance sports cars, prototypes and everything, I still think with all the downforce in IndyCar and everything and the lack of power steering and all that, the split-second decision-making is something you really only learn with seat time. So he didn't make it to the final. He only got to do 10 laps of racing in the first heat. But those 10 laps, I mean, about half of them were spent in wheel-to-wheel battles.
Good point. Yeah, that's going to pay off for him for sure. Callum Ilott ends up in ninth. He had started the heat in eighth. You know, like we said, he managed to get around as one of his teammates and led the McLaren trio there for a while, but eventually lost spots to both the teammates and was never able to get around Blomqvist. So he ends up in ninth. But I think he showed well during the tests and, you know, during that heat.
Yeah, I was hoping he would be the McLaren to transfer just because I think, you know, I just want to see him get a ride. I think he's a phenomenally talented open-wheel driver and deserves a spot in IndyCar. But was it meant to be? I mean, Rossi was just on a tear on Sunday. So, but he still showed really well. I imagine Malukas will be back in time for Long Beach. We've got about a whole month before that race, so I'd imagine he's healed. So, we'll see when we get Ilott in the car next, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Agreed. So Christian Rasmussen finishes in 10th. Just didn't really get to see much of these guys. I did, you know, go back and watch some of the replays today, and they were really dicing it up in at the beginning of this heat, but never got to see him again after that. So don't really know what happened back there, but he ends up in 10th ahead of Kiffin Simpson, who ends up in 11th again. Couldn't really tell what was going on, although able to stay ahead of Marcus Ericsson, which is no small feat. And then Colin Braun brings up the rear in 13th.
Yeah, so I thought Ericsson would come forward a little bit more, but I guess that's what I was expecting going into that race. I thought we were going to see a charge from Ericsson, but I guess I'm not, in hindsight, particularly surprised we didn't see it. Just because if you look at the pace of his teammates, I mean, Kirkwood really never had a sniff at transferring. Herta got in. I think he got a little bit of help from the guys being taken out in front of him and was the first to say that he really didn't have a lot of pace. The reason he wound up where he did in the final is because he sort of had the luxury of just backing off and tire saving that nobody else really had. I mean, everybody tire saved eventually, but nobody had the same luxury as Herta did for that one. So I guess I'm not surprised. And I also think the other thing about Ericsson is he tends to put together, you know, long form races, I guess, where 200 lap Indy 500, he shows up at about lap 198, you know, 100 lap St. Pete Grand Prix, all of a sudden lap 95, he's there. So 10 laps maybe doesn't suit his driving style as much either.
I agree. Okay, well, that's it from that event. Looking forward to Long Beach.
Yeah, looking forward to Long Beach.
I'm actually going to be there. So I haven't been to that race in probably 30 years. So really looking forward to that. Looking forward to reporting back.
Yeah, so just another quick reminder. Obviously, I think the whole event stirred up, the competition part of the event stirred up a lot of controversy on social media. But if you want to share your thoughts and maybe have a chance at us then sharing them with the larger IndyCar Fan Podcast audience, just go to IndyCarFanPodcast.com, click contact, and then shoot us a message, and we'll have a look.
All right. Thanks for joining us. I've got an outro here. The James Gang, Joe Walsh was leading the band, and basically it's kind of speaks for itself. Alex Palou kind of running away with it. It's called Walk Away.
Looks like my style, I don't wanna give seems to me.